This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. Today, we are very pleased to welcome on with us Jared Krause, founder and CEO of Buying Online Businesses. And we'll give all of our listeners a wild guess as to what we're going to be discussing today. It's going to have something to do with buying businesses, albeit in the digital space online. Jared, it's very good to have you on with us today. For those of you that are tuning in, the time difference between the two of us is it's almost 12 hours on, actually, it's 12 hours on the nose. So this is kind of an interesting one. The first for me talking to someone clear on the other side of the planet from myself here in Florida. So Jared, if you wouldn't mind, give us a little bit of background about yourself and kind of how you came to be in this particular franchise in life with what you're doing now.
Yeah, Alex, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate coming on and having the chat. My story, I guess, I grew up in Australia on the Gold Coast. My parents used to live in Melbourne and moved when I was about 8 or 9 to the Gold Coast, sunny Gold Coast, and went to school, did all the things as usual kid, and I really wanted to be wealthy when I was in school. And I just wanted money. And so I realized fast, though, that I wasn't the smartest kid in school. In fact, I got ranked down from advanced maths to what they would call the dumb maths, and also English as well. I got put into dumb English, and they used to call it Dinglish at school. And so I quickly realized that I wasn't going to become an accountant, which I had like an uncle on my mum's side who was a wealthy accountant. I thought that's going to be me. You know, I want to do that when I'm older. I quickly realized that that's not the case. So I had to become I tried to work out what was the one sort of trade that I could do in construction that would earn me the most amount of money. And I became a plumber, and I ended up hating my job as a plumber. I did that for about 10 years. I was lucky enough to get a decent job as a plumber, but still it wasn't for me. I worked my way through and became a supervisor. I worked my way out of that by trying to start a bunch of businesses. I found myself living in Egypt at one stage. I was working as a dive master between a bunch of different travels around the world surfing. And I realized I don't want to go back home to plumbing. I don't like that life. You know, I was working 70-hour work weeks, commuting 18 hours in the car per week. I think a lot of people really understand that, and a lot of people have been through that or going through that. A lot of my audience and clients are those types of people that want to replace their income and invest and build a financial, some sort of financial stability. So I tried to start an online business, and I sucked at it, to be honest. I failed multiple online businesses, and then I came across a stat after a couple of years of trying to start these businesses that 90% of all startups fail. And I thought, well, if 90% of these things fail, why don't I go away and buy something that's, you know, past that 90% failure rate, and I can grow it from there. And so I spent about 9 months, taught myself how to buy an online business, how to do all the due diligence myself. And I bought one, and it did really well. And then the year after, I bought another one that did really well. And then I bought a third one. So I bought 3 businesses in 3 years, and I do not recommend doing that, guys. And then I started traveling. I had these 3 businesses. I was traveling again, and people were like, hang on, man, what do you mean you're not working? You just do a couple of hours a week and you can travel forever. And they're like, you need to teach me how you can buy these businesses. And that's when I started teaching people, and then it blew up into a company. And yeah, now we help people either replace their income through buying businesses or build generational wealth for their families.
Fantastic. So I always like to kind of start at the beginning. I think it's the best place to start when kind of looking at any type of, you know, interesting investment structure that people have. So let's maybe kind of walk through that first deal. You know, you said that there was, you know, some, you know, certainly there's always going to be lessons learned. So you make this transition, you decide, hey, you know what, I don't want to be a plumber, you know, when I, you know, come back from doing, you know, being a dive master in Egypt or wherever you happen to be around the world. So, you know, you decide that, you know, doing businesses myself, starting them up, it's not working. So going past that threshold of failure. failure rate into acquiring them. That's a pretty, you know, pretty lofty step, I would say, from at least most people's perspective. And we'll probably certainly dissect that a little bit later on. But, you know, the thought process of saying, okay, I'm going to buy something that's already at a, you know, an established stage has to be a relatively daunting task, especially for someone that's never done it before. So how did you kind of crack into that at first? Like, what were some of the things that you learned? You know, if, you know, it, again, not trying to dive too much into what your personal holdings are, but, you know, what was the nature of that business? You know, as much detail as you can kind of give on that, I think would be really beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. It is a lofty sort of jump. And I just found myself desperate, Alex. I was just like, I need to, you know, I didn't like my job, but I was, you know, I was working big hours and it was leading me down like a dark path of, you know, drinking alcohol, and I needed to do something. So, I was pretty desperate. And so I had to take that jump. And I feel a lot of people have done this as well. Like when you've started an online business or started a business and you've done it and you've tried to make it work, it's so damn hard. And when you could buy something that's established, that jump doesn't seem as big when you're in it. From the outside, 100% agree with you, Alex. And so the first one, I saved up a bunch of money. I saved up $15,000. That was the first, you know, it's just a small little purchase. And it was a membership business. And the membership business is where people could pay, you know, monthly, quarterly, or annual fee to get access to a database of wholesalers and suppliers that they wanted to use when they were starting their own sort of drop shipping business. And so I thought, this is great. You know, I'm going to buy something that's got already recurring income and it's established. It's got the database of wholesalers and suppliers. And I had to do a bunch of research, and I ticked off most of the things that, you know, were quite good. The guy was just from Australia. He was living in Sydney. And so we had a bunch of phone calls, and that built my confidence in the seller, knowing that he was from Australia. And then I bought the business and realized, like, my big failure was after 6 months, I had people emailing and messaging us from the business saying, you know, there's a bunch of these suppliers that are no longer in business. And the database was sort of outdated, and it was going to cost me a lot of money to sort of reinvest and build out this database again, a lot of effort. And by this stage, I had bought another business that I'd started focusing on. So I kind of let that one go because of that reason. And that was a really good learning curve. The next acquisition was a larger acquisition. And I was very lucky to achieve like in 7 months, 100% return on my investment back. So I bought it for what I bought it for, I got back after 7 months. And that's just sort of kept my focus on that one versus the first one. And I learn every single time I buy something as well. And now, you know, I've looked at thousands and thousands of transactions through my clients. So, yeah.
So when you initially kind of start to crack into this, I'm a banker by heart, and I'm always interested, you know, when people get started about, you know, how exactly you go about financing something like this, because I think the thought process of determining, okay, hey, I'd like to do this. Okay, great. Now I see a business that's for sale, even better. I think that it's going to have X revenue. Awesome. But, you know, what makes the world turn being money. How do you kind of go about getting, you know, at least with that first deal financing? Have you just saved up and we're just like, all right, great, I'm going to rip a check and we're going to send it? Or was there something more creative that you did? Was it like owner financing or kind of how did you approach the actual like monetary aspect of financing the first one?
Yeah. So for me personally, it's a bit different. Being from Australia, and I understand how lucky and grateful I am. I earned a good wage as a plumber, and you know, the time that I bought a business, it was the Australian dollar was quite good, and so I saved up my money. You know, I believe Australia is a pretty good country, and it's quite affluent, so I was very, very lucky to be able to save. And my, you know, first three transactions, I bought them all cash. Now, I'm not always suggesting that for every single person because not everybody is in a similar situation to me. I was working, you know, those 70-hour work weeks and buying these businesses at the same time until I could, you know, get out of it. So I was very, adamant about achieving this result. Now, some people, you know, I was younger, no kids, single guy. I could do what I wanted when I wanted. It was pretty easy, you know. People listening have a different life situation. They might have a couple of kids and a family, wife, and all that sort of stuff, or, you know, a husband. And so with that, you can there is creative financing that you can use. I find a lot of people do use a HELOC to start off with, you know, in America. Most of the people that I work with are from America. So taking a little bit of equity out of the property that you have purchased, if you've got equity, and using that because you can get a lower interest rate than, say, maybe using an SBA loan. We do have clients that use SBA loans that you can acquire businesses with. So the Small Business Administration study, I'm sure most people listening probably have heard of that. If not, I can dive into that a little bit more. And then there is one other alternative. There is a company called Bupos that does financing for online businesses. Typically, though, if you're looking at buying a business around the $100,000 or less, or even the 100 to 200K range, most sellers are expecting cash, and financing can slow the deal down. So financing doesn't really come in until you're starting to buy something above the $100,000 to maybe $200,000 range anyway.
Okay, that's a really good point. So kind of demarcating like the type of acquisitions you can do. So basically, fair to say anything sub 100K, you kind of need to have, you know, cash on the barrel. You need to be able to basically come and close quickly. Now, what's kind of the time frame for some of these deals to close that are, you know, $100,000 still a lot of money. But again, in the grand scheme of this on the smaller end, what's kind of the closing time frame for, you know, acquiring something like that? Is it, you know, you make the offer and then it's, you know, 2 days later they expect a check? Like, you know, you have to have some due diligence and other things. So what are some kind of like typical timelines that are reasonable for that segment of the market?
Yeah, that segment of the market is a bit different to like 200K plus up into the seven figures. With that range is most people are finding these businesses listed on marketplaces online. So you've got like online brokers that sell online businesses, and they list these businesses for sale on their website, just like you would go shopping for real estate, I guess, or a house online. And so you can go away and pick those. They give you the numbers. They just tell you how much these businesses are worth, what they're selling them for, sorry, how much they're making, how much work is required. And I can recommend a few of those soon if you'd like. But in this price range, people will find those. They'll get all the information from the broker or the seller, and they'll do their due diligence before even making an offer. So they kind of do a little bit of due diligence before making an offer, and then they go away and make an offer. And when the offer is made, then they go to escrow, and then the deal, you know, works its way through migration once escrow is approved and all that sort of stuff. So with the larger acquisitions, a little bit different is like you typically find the business, you get a prospectus and you look at it, and then you decide, do I want to go to due diligence? And if you do, then you put in a letter of intent, and then you will, once that's sort of approved and everyone's happy with that, then you can go to due diligence, and then you can have obviously a letter of intent and everything subject to due diligence. Mm-hmm.
Cool. So let's back up a little bit. I really like the direction and the content that we got right there, the information. But I think it's probably best to back up a touch. So let's say, you know, let's look at someone kind of as a general avatar. So, you know, they have this desire to branch out and do something different. And again, you know, owning your own business, being your own boss is very attractive to a lot of people. It's why so many people, at least in, you know, my realm, love real estate. You know, it's a very accessible path for people to build that kind of generational wealth. But real estate's not for everyone. Tenants, toilets, dealing with bankers. I like to think I'm a good one, but, you know, having to deal with, you know, people, sometimes we get a bad rap. But, you know, understanding like, you know, someone that is, you know, desirous of doing this, what are some of the kind of first steps? So, you know, they've identified that they want to do this, but, you know, you're not just going on Facebook Marketplace or Craigslist or something and saying, hey, there's a business. I mean, maybe there are. I'm sure deals have been struck in other places. But, you know, let's kind of go the beginning processes of someone that wants to do this. What does it kind of look like? You know, is it always run through brokers? You know, is there a benefit to not using a broker and kind of doing the, you know, for sale by owner model where you go out and actually find these? Or is the kind of the time cost benefit just completely out of whack with that? And it's almost always better to go through like a professional intermediary.
Yeah, it's if you're buying the business, it's definitely better to go through a broker because you're not paying the commission to sell the business as a seller. You're the buyer. It doesn't matter. You can buy it for that price anywhere. So it's better to go through a broker typically because there is a bit more hand holding for beginners in terms of they will help with migration of the business and settlement and all that sort of stuff, you know, and escrow. And they also help with providing information, setting up calls and all those sorts of things. They typically do pre-vet the deal a little bit, but that said, you still really need to know how to do your due diligence. The reason my job still exists, like I started this to help people buy businesses. The reason it still exists is because there's so many people that will get taken advantage of if they don't use a professional or have professional eyes look over the deal before they either make an offer or go to contract. And so I would highly suggest going through more reputable brokers because, yeah, they do have a little bit of accountability, right? They got their brand and their name on the line. If they continue selling crappy businesses, they're not going to have the best reputation. Yeah. Sometimes these brokers will hide the fact that, or they won't make it public that, you know, why would they? I mean, that sometimes a deal didn't work out as well for the purchaser. I've had people come to me and say, hey, Jared, I bought a mid six figure business from this particular broker. It can't be named. And they came on my podcast and we can't name the broker. They came on the podcast to share their experience and how they got not taken advantage of, but obviously he's got to take responsibility as well that he didn't have me or anybody else look over the deal prior to purchasing. But he just wanted to come on and share his experience. And that happened through a pretty reputable broker. And I know this happens through a lot of different brokers. So yes, buy through a broker, but at the same stage, because it is easier, it does make the task easier. And you're typically buying through brokers, you're buying better and more established assets, businesses. When you're going through a marketplace, people that are selling through a Facebook marketplace or on a Facebook group or on a very open public marketplace with a lot of, I'll call them cheap listings, they do this because they want to not pay the brokerage fees and they want to sell it cheap. And typically these types of business owners, my head is in terms of the mindset is like, where else are they cutting corners and not, you know, trying to save expenses when they could just have a premium business, a premium brand. So that's the way I think about it anyway.
So to the point about what you're talking when it comes to the benefits of going through brokers and some potential issues that you can definitely have, I would most, you know, kind of to draw analogies to what some of our listeners might be familiar with is that, you know, it's kind of like going through, you know, any type, you know, real estate brokers, having a real estate agent, having someone that has, you know, capacity and typically depending on probably what country you're in, a legal responsibility to act in your best interest. And there's definitely a benefit to that. So while yes, you know, you might be paying a premium for some type of service like that, you're not getting nothing for your dollar. You know, more often than not, people think, for whatever reason, people in the whatever sales or brokerage business kind of get a bad rap, but you know, they're the experts in this, you know, unless you are, you know, someone like yourself, Jared, who really knows all the ins and outs, you know, having that type of protection and someone to look over it is definitely a beneficial service. So now, you know, someone says, okay, great. You know what? I think buying an established business is going to give me that path to creating whatever type of life that I want, whether that's financial freedom, just wanting to be their own boss, whatever it happens to be. They've decided that, you know, buying a business is kind of what they'd like to do. Now, just like with anything, especially for real estate, you have things like inspections. You have all the different things that people are kind of used to, a home inspection report, termite inspections, foundation inspections, if there's issues with that. What kind of things are provided when it comes to sitting down and saying, okay, I'm going to do my due diligence? Because that's so much of this is not just having the money and finding a business. It's making sure that the business is something that's worth buying at the end of the day. You know, if you're going to shell out $100, $200, $1 million for something, making sure that it is, you know, worth your time and effort is important. So I think the next logical step is kind of let's dive into what does due diligence look like on a business?
Yeah, awesome. Great question. I also buy and invest in property. We call it property in Australia. So real estate for you guys, And when you're buying a commercial real estate, say building like retail or something like that, you are doing your due diligence a lot on the tenant, which is on the business. So it's very similar to, because you want to make sure that lease agreement or tenant agreement is very solid and very good, you know. So it's very similar to buying online businesses. What you're looking at is you're looking at things like the profit and loss statement. Very, very important. And you're getting that, you're looking at yourself on the 100K deals, and, you know, I advise and help on that, deals under that, you know, mid six figure range. Above that, you're getting a CPA to look at the finances and verify all of that. You're also then looking at the marketing. What are they doing in terms of marketing? How much does it cost? What's their return? Then you're looking at, you know, the SEO, the traffic, the trends of the traffic. Is the traffic going up? Is it going down? Is it going sideways? Why? Based on what inputs you have put into the business over X amount of time frame. Then you're also looking at competitive due diligence, looking at, you know, what else is out there in the landscape. What are they doing really well? What are they not doing so well? Where is that position, the business that I'm looking at purchasing? And then you also do your due diligence on the owner, you know, check, make sure they're a real person and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, SEO, search engine optimization. If they are using SEO, you know, what type of work has been done to build out their search engine optimization, what work has not been done based on, you know, the competitors, and where does that position that business in the landscape. Now each business is a bit different because there's three main business models. The first one is what I would categorize as like SaaS or membership, software as a service or membership business. The second one is e-commerce businesses. And there's a few different types of e-commerce businesses. They could be e-commerce businesses that are, you know, Amazon businesses. So fulfillment by Amazon, FBA, we call them. It could be a dropshipping e-commerce business. It could be a self-product distribution business. Yeah. And then you could have media businesses, which is a third category. A media business is like a blog. It could be a travel blog, could be a food blog, could be a blog about any particular niche, like surfing, kayaking, fishing, whatever it is. And or it could be a media business that is just like a YouTube channel or Instagram account or a Facebook account. And how these make money is typically through sponsored posts, ad revenue, affiliation, commissions, and stuff like that.
Okay, great. Now, that's kind of a lot of stuff to kind of pack into a typical closing window, you know, especially when it comes to doing market research and different things like that, and, you know, making sure you're not buying a business that's going to be selling something that's going to be outlawed in 2 days. You know, buying a lead paint distributor in the 70s might have been a bad call. So things like that. It's kind of a lot to take in as far as what you do for all that. Now, how much are the brokers involved in helping with that due diligence? I'm assuming just to be able to have a broker, you probably have to at least kind of, you know, if you're looking to sell the business, they're probably coming up and saying, hey, Mr. Broker, Mrs. Broker, here's my P&L statement. You know, here's my, you know, net income for the previous 3 or 4 years. Here's, you know, location, nature of business, employees, kind of probably some general stuff. But again, it's not just saying, hey, you know, we sold a bunch of stuff. To the lead paint analogy, they could have, you know, if they sold it the previous year, they could sold millions of gallons, but they can't sell any the following year. So how do you kind of take all of that in and know what else to ask? You know, what are some of good things for people, you know, maybe not using an advisor like you, what are some just good things to also make sure that is included when you get that kind of due diligence packet, if you will?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the brokers are pretty involved. What they do is they typically present a prospectus and give a bunch of information to the purchasers, and then they manage the purchasers based on who they, you know, who they form a better relationship with. What you get is basically what they want to give you. And luckily enough, I've been in the industry quite a while now, and I give out a due diligence framework that a lot of people go away and use. You can get it for free if people want it. Just go to my site, whatnot. And you can, through that framework, there's a bunch of questions that you can ask to the broker or the seller to get the specific information that you need to have everything you need to be identified, to identify if the business is a good investment or not. Basically takes the guesswork out of it. Obviously, you want an advisor like myself overlooking that due diligence framework. And this due diligence framework, it's been formulated over many years. Many businesses have been bought through this. It's helped many people save millions of dollars and make millions of dollars. And through this framework, it's also formulated basic guidelines on what the brokers and the sellers and the information the sellers give you now, because so many of our audience and clients use this to extract information. And because it's been done so many times, now the brokers, it's held the brokers and sellers in our industry accountable to providing that information before it even being asked now. So get my framework if you haven't got it or you want to go down this path, not to just self-promote that, but some questions in there are like, basically what we talked about before is like the marketing, the traffic, the SEO, competitive due diligence on the owner, and financial due diligence.
Sounds good. So
around those. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of, you know, that's definitely a good place to start. So now, are mainly the businesses that you focus on, at least with advising your clients, you know, people understand businesses come in all shapes and sizes, you know, whether it's, you know, drop shipping on Amazon or, you know, the gas station down the corner from my house. What is kind of your focus and specialty? And are these businesses that you're typically looking at ones that are kind of owner operated, or do they have rank and file employees? Tell us a little bit about kind of what your focus is and what you help advise your clients on, or is it kind of across the board and varying different industries and types?
Yeah, it's not so much. I'm not industry specific, and I'm not business model specific either. Typically, we're helping people buy, you know, most people come to me and want to buy a media business and a content business, right? Or they want to buy an e-commerce business, a SaaS, a membership business, and they realize that they're at a certain stage in their investment cycle or career, based on how much money they have and how much experience they have in terms of buying a business, typically nothing, or owning an online business. And then we start them off in a linear fashion. Typically, we start them off with the media business because it's slower paced, easier to run. And then we move them into whichever category they want. It's either a SaaS or membership business or a, you know, e-commerce business. E-commerce business is, I typically don't advise people to go down the e-commerce business route unless they have experience in e-commerce and marketing. Because most of these businesses are owner operated that most people are starting, right? They want to buy something based on the amount of investment capital that they have. They're going to be buying something based on an owner occupier sort of business. Sometimes we're buying businesses that might have 5 employees, but typically nothing above, you know, into the 8-figure range of type of assets that I'm helping people purchase. At the moment.
Gotcha. No, absolutely. Now, one thing that I kind of just thought of is that, you know, when it comes to buying a business, especially, you know, if it's not owner operated, are when you buy these businesses, is it something that people need to really kind of have an honest look at themselves about saying, hey, look, like, do I really want to be operating this business, or do these things typically get sold with built-in management? I'm sure there's a spectrum of it, but maybe kind of go down that path a little bit of saying, hey, like, here's some of the things to look out for. You know, if you've never managed a person, never had to deal with an HR complaint, you know, buying a business with 20 employees that was run by the owner might be something to better look, you know, be better suited to something a little bit more owner operated, so you can understand what it is to be an operator and manager. I'm sure that is probably kind of a big hurdle for a lot of people.
Yeah, I absolutely love this question, Alex. And a lot of people come to me and their goal is money, right? They want to make more money. But in reality, their goal is not more money, right? That's a byproduct. Yeah, it's more time. Yeah, so I help people, like, our mission is to not just help people make money, and we do. People make fabulous amounts of money through our help, but what's far more valuable and our business values and my core values is we help people buy businesses so they can spend more time doing what they love with the people they love. And so when it comes to investing in an online business, they might go, this business or this type of business, it's making X amount of money and this is what I want. Like, hang on, is it really what you want though? Is it that you want to work? You want to buy yourself a job, do you? So you can make that money. Like, do you want to get out of one 40-hour week job to get into a 40 to 50-hour week job? but you'll be making more money. Is that really what you want? And then it's a harsh reality check of like, oh, hang on a second. Like, I want to do this so I can maybe work 10 to 20 hours a week or 10 to 15 hours a week and then still earn the same amount of money through what I was doing in my previous role, previous job, but earn the same amount of money but do less work and then build on top of it from there. And each business will be different in terms of how much owner involvement is in place. So I like to help people optimize for lifestyle, because once you have a better lifestyle, typically you're going to be a better performer and then you're going to make more money anyway, typically. So that's what I help people do. And yeah, it's just a conversation that we need to have, because I help people set out their lifestyle goals as well. And we go from there.
Gotcha. Now, are there certain industries or specific types of businesses that skew one way or another towards offering, you know, more time? And or trying to figure out how to formulate this question. Is there a direct correlation of like time involvement with a particular business and the amount of money that's generated? And are there some industry specific ones that tend to skew better in the time and money allotment? Are there some that are just going to be, you know, buying another job? Like inherently, typically in those types of industries, and again, kind of to that context of this part of the industry.
Yeah, it's a great question. That answer depends on the size of the asset that you're purchasing. Typically, people buying under the $1 million range it's better for them if they want more time independence and less work in the business. It's better for them to buy a media business, like a blog or a content site or something like that, because it can be less owner involvement. And then you can hire people to come in and take over your roles. As you start to get into the larger sort of asset class, it really depends on how much owner involvement is already in the business or how much team they've hired and using to run the business. Now, you asked a question before that I didn't get to answer, is that, you know, is it better for people to spend more time working on the business at the start to learn how to run the business? Or is it better that they just buy the business and then they manage it? Well, a lot of people believe it's better to know how to do the work and then move into, you know, a management role. And I understand that logical thinking. However, I don't believe that is absolutely necessary. I like to learn tasks and things that are evergreen. And if I am to learn how to write a blog or how to run Facebook ads myself, I know that that might change based on how SEO optimized blog should be and how running ads on Facebook or Google will change in 2 years' time, maybe 1 year's time, 1 year's time, right? So I might be learning a task to run this business, but it might not be evergreen, versus if I bought a business that already has a, you know, Facebook ads manager in place, or bought a business that already has, you know, writers and content creators for the business. Typically, it's not going to be, I'm going to be learning a more valuable task in terms of how to manage an ad manager and how to manage a writing team versus me doing it myself. So I don't think it's absolutely necessary for people to get in at the base level and then do all the work and progress through the ranks. I don't believe I think that can be a limiting belief. I did it
for sure,
myself,
yeah.
But I think it can be a limiting belief, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's no, absolutely. And I think it's also probably, you know, there's definitely some of the human factor too, you know, if it's someone that's dead set on it. But I think the important thing to take away from that is that, you know, you don't have to be married to that idea. You know, it doesn't have to be incorporated as a limiting belief. You know, certainly if that's something that, you know, works well for you, just like, you know, I told you I like taking paper notes. You know, it's a little old school, you know, it's what works for me, but you know, everything's going to probably work a little bit different for everyone. And that's one kind of key concept of this podcast that I really like to make sure people get, is that there's not one linear path to anything. You know, we're talking about buying online businesses, and there's so many different industries, two ways to do it, you know, different involvement that you have, you know, you're going to find something that works for you. You don't have to think that just because, oh, well, you know, you have to be really hands-off with this stuff. You can find something if you want to be hands-on. If you want to, you know, create more time for yourself, but also be able to have another thing that, you know, takes up some of your time because you enjoy the work, albeit there's definitely an option for you there. So before we kind of get into the last couple segments that I really want to cover, albeit in the nature of financing and then post-acquisition, I always like to ask anyone that's on this podcast, especially in positions like yourself. What are some like stumbling blocks that a lot of people kind of hit? You know, is it just mindset related? Is it financial? Like, what are some things that when people come and either go through you or that you've just seen people, you know, have these issues time and time again, what are some of those issues that you see kind of just crop up perennially for people?
I love this question. It is definitely not the vehicle. The vehicle is not the issue, right? You can make money investing in anything. You've seen anybody do it, right? Everybody do it in all different industries and crush it. It's just like the also anybody that's achieved any level of success, right? You know, in anything, they've done it. They've paved the way. So it's not the vehicle. It's definitely a mindset issue. And most of them are mindset issues. The biggest thing that gets in my way is me. I'm playing a game against me. And most people are playing a game against themselves and they don't realize it. And we typically set ourselves up to fail. I am far more proud of the mindset trainings that I, you know, have put out there for, you know, my clients than the vehicle stuff, right? Like, you, if you do this, you'll get X result. Just follow this path and do it. The biggest thing that gets people results is the mindset stuff. And the one biggest one that I find is people set themselves, why and how people set themselves up for failure is an unconscious thing, but it's an expectation. They set themselves an expectation that they're completely not conscious of. I'll give you an example. People will listen to my podcast and they will hear somebody, somebody bought a business in 3 months and they're making $3,000 a month now. And only took them 3 months to do. And that's great. Well, I'll put that out as a title. It'll be a little bit clickbaity, but it's real. It's a real result. And somebody's bought this business. I met them 3 months ago and they're making $3,000 a month. That's pretty damn attractive, right? So people that listen to this or watch this, they go, damn, I'm going to do Jared's thing now. And unconscious, they go, okay, 3 months time, I should be making $3,000 a month. And then they join this program and they get to the 3 month mark range and they're like, I haven't bought a business yet. And this is where self-doubt and this is where, you know, the mindset stuff is so important, is that it's not the vehicle. It's not that the vehicle doesn't work, right? It's their expectation is like, I should own a business and I should be making X amount of money now based on some other thing, right? It's just like saying, oh, I want to become a sprinter, and we set ourselves up to fail by going, I need to get to the goal of Usain Bolt, right? And they're sprinting that. And like, how long did Usain Bolt take to get there? Also, is there like genetics at play? Is like, who knows, right? So if somebody comes into my program and they say, after 3 months, this didn't work for me, and they leave, what they're going to do is they're going to go chase the shiny object syndrome and go to another program. And then it's not going to work out for them. And another program, people are just going to continue finding something else, chasing the shiny object syndrome. I've done this. I was the rabbit chasing too many hares and catching none of them. So that's probably the biggest one, is realizing that, like, if you're going to invest in anything, not just even buying an online business, I would advise choose a route and stick with it for 5 to 10 years minimum. And what you're going to get is you're going to get this compounding effect that allows you to achieve far better results than you unconsciously and initially unconsciously expected from yourself. I'll give you an example. Warren Buffett, I don't know, he's worth billions and millions of dollars, right? But 90% of his wealth was only attained in the last few years. And he's been doing this for 40 decades, right? So one of the best investors in the world, let's follow him. Let's do what he does. And he hasn't said he didn't get into this game thinking, oh, I want to become, you know, one of the richest men in the world. He just was obsessed and a geek. So I think mindset is the biggest thing that gets in the way. And that's just one little mindset thing of like, oh, an expectation. There's other things like self-doubt. And yeah, there's a lot of value there.
Yeah, it's fun that you pick on Warren Buffett because he's, you know, kind of basically in the same, you know, market that you are, albeit on a significantly bigger level. But that's what Berkshire Hathaway did, is buy and acquire businesses. I mean, think Geico Insurance. You know, that's Warren Buffett, and he bought that back in the 50s. You know, it's again, I'm a big fan of Warren Buffett for some things, you know, again, with everyone, I disagree a little bit on his investment philosophy to a point. I think it's a little boring, but I mean, boring's made him a billionaire many times over. So, hey, you know, who am I to judge?
Yeah, but I think Warren Buffett is like, you're right. It is boring. And my business is, you know, buying, if you do it for so long, like buying real estate, right? If I'm just buying a residential property after residential property, it's like, it's gets boring. But does it work? Yeah, yeah. It makes good money. But just keep doing it because it's working, right? And this is where the shiny object syndrome comes in my opinion. It's like, oh, this is boring. I need to do something more exciting. Let's just take it all and go into crypto. Let's get a bit of a rush and then, oh no, what have I done? Right? Maybe it was amazing and you got this awesome rush and then you sold out and then you're looking for the next high and, you know, it's I think sticking with boring, my investment philosophy is highly based off Warren Buffett's.
Yeah, I mean, there's worse people to kind of track, you know, through the ages of being, you know, stalwarts of investors and, you know, and integrity investing. You know, there's very few titans of industry that can kind of, you can look back on, you know, with, you know, the historical lens and say, you know, they really haven't done anything too terribly scrupulous. You know, anyone, if you examine far enough, I'm sure someone's probably angry out there. But on the general whole, he's a pretty good guy to kind of model a philosophy off of. Now, to the point of financing, because the next part of this whole thing is money. We touched on it a little bit in the beginning. But you said there's definitely some different routes and avenues towards financing. And the sub-$100,000 ones, again, typically close pretty fast. You kind of need to have cash on hand to acquire something in the sub-100K range. But once you start getting above that, financing and other types of options start to come into play. So let's kind of explore that a little bit. If you're looking in the businesses a little bit farther up, you know, we've covered due diligence. It's kind of easy to supplant that into the context of, say, I have cash, I've done the due diligence, it works, let's go. So when it comes to doing the slightly bigger deals that need to have financing or that financing is an option for, because just because you have 300 grand in the bank to buy a business, you know, why not finance it? Put, you know, 30% down or 33%, you know, put 100 grand down and then be able to buy three businesses at 300 grand with that same 300. So, you know, let's explore a little bit about the financing route to this. You mentioned things like HELOCs and SBA loans. For people in the United States, there's interesting things with retirement plans called ROBS plans, which I, for whatever reason, at my company, I'm the one that knows the most about, so I get those questions a lot. but yeah, so let's explore some of the context of, you know, acquiring financing for some slightly larger businesses.
Yeah, so like you said, we talked about sub-100K, mostly cash. For SBA, typically you're not going to be able to buy a business for less than 350K range. So SBA starts to come in from 350K and above, and typically you're going to want about a 20% deposit for SBA. Same if you're going to use, alternative financing, like a company called Bupos, to acquire a business, you're typically going to need 20%. Now, to get financing, you do need to be eligible and they're going to need to do due diligence on you as a person and what entrepreneurial or business experience you have or don't have or your resume as well, or CV or whatever you want to call it. So yeah, I don't know what other questions you want to ask about financing in terms of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So to explore that a little bit deeper, so what kind of additional like time buffers are added in for needing to acquire financing? So if you wanted to go the SBA route, and just for people, the quick math is that you basically need to have at least, you know, 70 grand is roughly the bottom down payment that you would need for something in the context of what you're talking about. And it's scaling up from there. So call it, you need at least 100 grand in disposable funds. That's not your last bottom dollar in order to be able to get into the SBA kind of bracket, if you will. Now, for everyone that's listening that's familiar with real estate, you know, cash is always going to be quicker. Financing just takes longer. So what other kind of things are they just looking at with the SBA side of things? Are they looking at just you and your business acumen in the industry that you're going into? Or are they examining the acquired business at all as well?
Yeah, both. They're definitely both. So there's even some brokers that will list businesses for sale that have been SBA qualified. And so let's talk about timeframes to your question. Timeframes is typically, it might be like 4 weeks of, like, you might go to somebody to get SBA and it might take them 4 weeks to be able to go, yep, this is, you know, I can use, we can finance a Jared. And then you've got approval, right? You're SBA qualified. Then you can go away and find businesses. And if you have a business that you're purchasing that's already SBA qualified from a broker, typically it's going to be lesser time frame, right? It depends on the size of the business and what's involved in the business as well, because SBA will be looking at both the human being and also the business to make sure that, you know, can this human run this business? They're purchasing it. This business, you know, is it going to be something we want to finance again? And do we also want Jared financing, using finance to buy this business? It's a win-win-win. It might take anywhere from like a month to 2 months. The larger acquisitions typically take 2 months. The smaller acquisitions usually take a little bit less.
Okay, gotcha. And what's the typical turnaround time on an all-cash acquisition? I don't know if we specifically stated that.
Yeah, we haven't. But so it depends. It depends on the broker, the seller, the due diligence. Also depends on how many other competitive buyers are out there as well. I'll give you one example though. There is a broker that you can show proof of funds. Well, you need to show proof of funds to them before they share businesses with you, their information. And then you can also have funds on file. So you can send them funds, they'll put it into an account. And then when you want to buy a business from them or a business that they list, then you see a business come up for sale and you're like, yep, this is good. You can just click, you know, pay your deposit, and the deposit is paid for that. And basically then you've got like, I don't know, 24 hours to do DD, and then you can have it done. So literally on that marketplace or that platform, people have listed businesses for like 75 grand, and within like a minute that business has been purchased. So typically though, the typical time frame is somebody will find a business after a day or few that it's been listed, then they'll do due diligence over a couple of days, depending on who they're doing the due diligence with and who's helping them advise them, how long that might take. And it might take a week to get to 1 to 2 weeks to get to an agreement on price. And then you'll have escrow. You put the money into escrow, and then typically it's a 14 day inspection period. So typically, like, from finding the business to around 30 days ish to owning the business. Yeah.
So all cash can be, you know, as quick as a week up to typically probably about a month. And then stuff from that kind of probably just scales accordingly. You know, it's, you know, once you start getting into multiple millions, you know, stuff starts taking significantly longer, as it probably should if you're going to shell out that kind of money. So, you know, we've kind of covered a good amount of content so far, you know, from the why to the who to the what. And let's look at, you know, after you've done this, let's say you've wrapped up a deal, you know, what is kind of the goal, or I should say, rephrase this, you know, what's kind of the typical actions afterwards? You know, you got this business, you know, you've certainly hopefully talked to someone like yourself that's an expert enough to kind of guide you, saying, hey, like, here's the things you need to look at, of like, hey, maybe how to manage it, here's the resources to do so. But what's kind of the, you know, end goal for a lot of this? Is it to acquire more and more? Is it to kind of acquire and sell, like reposition and sell, merge? Like, what are some of the typical post-close strategies that you see people using?
Great question. It's typically when people do due diligence and work with us, is we highlight risks, and then we give them risk mitigation strategies, which are actually growth strategies as well. So on the outset, it's like the first month, don't do anything. First, maybe 2 months, don't do anything. Just learn the business and don't change too much. And then start to execute some of those growth strategies and risk mitigation strategies, which will help grow the business. Now, from there, like longer term goals, most people that come to us, they want to build a portfolio of businesses, or, you know, portfolio of like assets that are in the same industry, I guess. So, Yeah, that's the main goal. Typically, I'll find that people will purchase one, and sometimes people want to buy more and more and more, and I try and hold them back from doing that too fast, because I did that. I think you achieve better results with more focus, right? There's a really good book called The One Thing by Gary Keller. And focusing on that one asset and working on it entirely until you want to split your focus to something else. And once you are done with that business, then you can either put managers in place or put more people in place to do more of the work and acquire something else and merge it and add together. Or you can sell that business and acquire a larger asset. I heard a really good thing from one of my wealth mentors, which is if your goal is wealth generation, you need concentration. If you want wealth preservation, you need diversification. So a lot of people coming to me are for wealth creation, so they need concentration in terms of focus. If you get to the point that you get to like, oh, cool, I'm making whatever your goal is, maybe you're making 500K net a year or whatever. Once you get to that goal and you don't want to take on, you know, too much more work or risk, then you can start to diversify based on that philosophy. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that kind of takes us, even though my producer is not on here right now, now's about the time she starts kind of sending me a message to try to wrap things up. We could certainly talk for much longer. I find this really interesting because of all the investment types that we've talked about with different people on here, I can safely say it's the first guest that we've had on, Jared, that we've talked about, you know, buying businesses, which I find fascinating. Anytime I get to kind of learn new stuff, I'm always the better for it. I had no idea that there were actual, you know, kind of business brokers out there, and to a point, but just so far as that, you know, just how maybe wide the marketplace is, that there's someone literally sitting on the other side of the world that's helping people in the United States and abroad just, you know, pick, choose, buy, sell, manage, and, you know, rinse, wash, repeat, if you will, on this type of marketplace. So, you know, definitely really appreciate your time. I know it's the end of my day here and it's just getting to be 8 a.m. where you are right now. So with that said, any kind of parting thoughts or anything that you feel that we didn't cover that you want to kind of snatch up at the end of this?
No, I think that was like, you asked just seriously good questions, Alex. And I just want to like, just acknowledge you as a host. Like I'm a host of a podcast and like, you're really good. So thank you for having me on and the questions. And yeah, in terms of parting stuff, I would just say, guys, understand what's the goal. What's the real goal? Is it really just money, or is it, yeah, more time doing what you love with the people you love and optimize for that?
Fantastic. And if they want to get in touch with you and interested in learning more, how can they get in touch with you, Jared?
Yeah, if you go to buyingonlinebusinesses.com, you can check out all my stuff, or just type my name into most of the platforms, YouTube, Google. Check out my podcast and that'll be able to help you get a start to see if, you know, I'm somebody that might be able to help you. If not, then maybe I can put you to somebody that can help you.
All right. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I always like to end this off by thanking our guests because the most valuable resource we all have is our time. And thank you for spending an hour of it with us today. With that said, this has been the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. As always, my name is Alex Perney, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of the Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at AdvantaIRA.com and subscribe.